Every month, APS journals publish fascinating insights into how we humans think, interact as a society, and treat one another. This research covers topics that matter to each of us personally, including aging, bias and discrimination, the mental impact of COVID, and the fundamental workings of the human brain. All compelling stuff. The writing in journal articles in any science, however, is notoriously technical. The charts, graphs, and jargons can leave the average reader scratching their head. But fear not. We have something a little more approachable and entertaining. Our magazine, The Observer. This bi-monthly publication contains stories written by a team of skilled journalists who look beyond the journals and jargon to present some compelling findings from the field of psychological science. Today, I talk with three members on our team and ask them what they think are the most interesting topics in our latest issue, and perhaps a hint at what to expect in future issues. Let me start with the editor of The Observer, Leah Thayer. Welcome to Under the Cortex.
Thanks, Charles. I'm really excited to be here. I love the podcast, and I'm so glad that you're giving The Observer a chance to participate.
You have the pleasure, or perhaps the challenge, of giving the magazine the final read each issue. Apart from the proofing and copy editing, how often do you just pause a moment and go, wow, that's really amazing?
You know, I do that sometimes, especially when I get the issue in the mail, the actual physical printed issue, because then we can really get a sense of the heft and see how every single page worked out. It's a very gratifying process. I will tell you that every issue takes months to put together, and it sometimes feels like endless levels of evaluating and editing and revising, and of course, all the many, many, many different design iterations. But I'm really proud of what we're able to accomplish with our very small team.
Well, we just put the September-October issue to bed. The central issue of this is combating stereotypes and bias. That's a huge area of study. What facets do we look at specifically in this issue of The Observer?
You are absolutely right. It is a huge area to study, and narrowing down our options when we have these broad themes is always challenging, but it's also a gift in many ways. So this issue does cover a range of topics from intergroup conflict to ending the stigma against people with intellectual disabilities to broadening gender-affirming support and medical care for people who are transgender. And in every article and in every issue, we always strive to promote the integration of scientific perspectives. For instance, the article about stigma against people with disabilities was written by Emily Hotez. She's a developmental psychology researcher at UCLA, and she's also the sister of an autistic adult. And she cites a wide range of research from journals focused on developmental issues, medicine, disability health, and quite a bit more in demonstrating how a lifetime of stigma has a direct impact on the health outcomes of people with disabilities.
So if you were to recommend one of these articles to a friend who's not a scientist, but someone who's keen on science, what would it be?
Gosh, I don't know if I could recommend only one, but I would really strongly suggest the interview between Jennifer Eberhardt, who studies race and inequality at Stanford, and she's also the APS board president, and Linda Tropp. She's a professor of social psychology at the University of Massachusetts. And the two of them, they talk about the incredibly impactful role that intergroup contact can have. One example is simply having positive neighborhood experiences with members of another race or ethnicity, and the powerful role that such forms of contact can help in making white people, for instance, more aware of their privilege and more likely to participate in collective action for racial justice.
I ask this question to most of the researchers I talk with and people who've been involved in fundamental studies, and that is there anything that popped out at you that you didn't expect or was surprising? So was there something you came away with and go, wow, I really did not know that?
Absolutely. There was quite a bit, and quite a few of them were certainly eye-opening. We launched a series in the September-October issue on essentially why psychological science needs to be more global. And it's written by a team of researchers all over the world in Africa and South America and Europe. And we're going to continue this series in the November-December issue. We're going to look at how the history and legacies of colonialism have impacted psychological science in the developing world. And in part one, they make a really compelling case for something I suspected to be true, but I did not realize the extent of, and that is psychological science's dominance by researchers in the United States. And, you know, we often hear about the broader bias or a broader bias in favor of countries characterized by the acronym WEIRD for Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. But I was really surprised to see how U.S. researchers in particular get the lion's share of articles published and also receive the majority of prestigious awards. And obviously, there are many reasons why this is a problem. And one is simply the fact that it means that many theories, many psychological theories, are loaded with assumptions that are embedded in U.S. culture, like our individualistic ideal, for instance, which so much of the world doesn't have. And it also, it hurts the field's attempts to create psychological theories that are relevant to the wider world. And, you know, the United States we're a big country, but we're certainly only a very, very, very small percentage of the population around the world.
So the Observer does try to address these broader topics, not just in the science that is psychological science, but in society more broadly. Certainly of interest to many people, but I guess you can't get this on your local newsstand, can I? So where do we go to find this content?
Yeah, it's not available on the newsstand. You're right about that, if newsstands still exist. But the articles are available on the APS website. So you just go to psychologicalscience.org/observer. And you can find articles going back many years through APS and from the Observer. And for now, at least, anybody can even download a PDF of the entire issue of the Observer. So again, that's psychologicalscience.org/observer.
Thanks so much for joining me, Leah.
Thank you, Charles. I enjoyed it.
My next guest is no stranger to Under the Cortex, APS senior science writer, Dr. Ludmila Nunj. Welcome back, Ludmila.
Hi, Charles. Thanks for having me again.
Always delightful. So in this issue, we have a story about memory, its failings, and how it can lead to mistakes in the criminal justice system. I know you've done some research on memory and how it works. Can you tell us about this particular story?
Yeah, of course. I really enjoyed reading this story and working a little bit with the authors, who are Michael Toglia from Cornell University and Garrett Berman from Roger Williams University. And this story, it has its roots on this project called the Innocence Project, and it has to do with how so many people have been convicted, and then years later, it was found out that they were wrongfully convicted. So the criminal justice system was designed to find and punish people who actually committed the crime, but with the advent of DNA research, we started seeing many convicted people being exonerated. And these wrongful convictions, most of them were based on eyewitness testimony. So someone would testify about a certain event that they saw, and that would be enough to convict someone.
So what does this actually discuss in the story that we have in our magazine?
So since 1989, about 2,800 wrongful convictions have been reversed, most of them due to DNA evidence, and 185 people who were exonerated were actually in death row. So this is even more important in the US, where there is a death penalty. Even more important are the societal aspects of overturning these wrongful convictions, because half of these exonerated people, more than half, were people of color. So there is a huge disparity between the wrongful convictions of white people and people of color. And this is also connected with the fact that some of the eyewitness evidence came from cross-racial identifications. So we tended to have a white witness testifying against a black witness, for example. And it has been shown that our memory can be really biased by beliefs or prior history, or even assumptions that we make about someone and having difficulty in recognizing someone's faces, for example.
So is this story about personal recollections, how bad our own memories are when compared to what actually happened in real life?
It has a lot to do with how bad our memory is about things that happened to us. So it's not that our memory is just bad, but contrary to what many people think, memory is not just playing a tape, for example. We don't hold copies of events. Every time we are recalling things, we are changing what we recall. So our memory is mostly constructive. And even the first time we recall something, it might not be exactly what happened.
It can also be malleable, as I understand. Things that have happened after the event can rewrite what we think we know as fact from the past. Was that brought into what the authors talk about here?
Yes. So in this story, the authors actually talk about how we have factors that occur during the event and are going to influence how we recall that event. And those can be the stress, the anxiety that the event causes, the race of the perpetrator, and then physical aspects like distance or lighting. And then there are the factors that are going to play a role during testimony itself. And here we are talking about, for example, how lineup procedures are conducted and how sometimes they can even mislead the witness.
So it's almost as if I really can't tell the difference of who's up there. My memory's a little faulty, but subtle cues from the other people in the room may be leading me to implicate someone who was indeed not even guilty.
Exactly. For example, one of the recommendations to conduct more fair lineup procedures is that the administrator of the procedure does not know who the suspect actually is. So that person cannot give any cues to the eyewitness. Another aspect is, for example, not having suspects that stand out in the lineup. Because if we have someone who is very similar to the perpetrator, but the other people in the lineup are very different, the eyewitness is more likely to select that person that stands out and is very similar to the perpetrator.
And in these instances, if I recall, the actual victim of a crime may, after a lineup, assign the face of the person they identified to the actual memories themselves and can reinforce the false memories, which makes it even more challenging to untangle what really happened.
Yes. So that's when, after a lineup procedure, for example, then the eyewitness goes and testifies in court, those memories can become even more solidified and the witness can really believe that they're making the right identification and they're not.
This ties into another story that we wrote up about a month or so ago. It wasn't in The Observer, but it had to do with memory of location. And it's really remarkable how poor people are at remembering where they were at a particular time. In this particular case, people had GPS devices and recording devices, an app on their iPhone, and when asked later where they were at any given time, they could confuse location, they could confuse dates, they can confuse weeks against weeks. So really showing that memory is not something you want to rely on when it comes to determining someone's guilt or innocence.
Exactly. As you said in the beginning, memory is very malleable, it's flexible, it's a constructive process, and it's very easy to have false memories. It's very easy to misremember things, to intrude memories, and also to forget things. The reason for this is not that our memory is a faulty process. On the contrary, our memory works this way because that's highly adaptive. It's important for our survival. It's important to navigate the world. We cannot keep records of everything. It actually helps us learn. But if we are deciding someone's life, maybe we should not rely only on eyewitnesses and on memory.
That is a good recommendation as we take a look at the impact of psychological science on the judicial system, one of several approaches we've had to this. And I'd like to thank you for your time and for your insights and look forward to discussing our next issue when it comes out later this year.
Thanks, Charles.
And to wrap things up for today, I'd like to bring in my colleague and the assistant managing editor for The Observer, Kim Armstrong. Kim, welcome to Under the Cortex.
Thanks, Charles. Happy to be here.
You open your article, Rain Before Rainbow, with a quote from the iconic drag performer and entertainer RuPaul, saying, "We're all born naked and the rest is drag." That's a rather amusing way to set the stage for a really deep dive into the science of transgender flourishing. Can you tell us the main gist of your article and what you were hoping to uncover?
Yeah, so I wouldn't, you know, necessarily describe myself as a RuPaul super fan or anything, but I've always really appreciated that quote because I think it gets at the socially, culturally constructed nature of gender. You know, none of us are born wearing eyeshadow or jeans or anything like that. We just kind of collect it as we're going along in life. And, you know, similarly, gender isn't really as fixed as we're often told it is. And there are numerous benefits to people who are both, you know, trans or cisgender to sort of acknowledging that complexity, which is something that Tekla Morgenroth gets into in their Perspectives on Psychological Science article, in case anyone is interested in reading more about that. My intent was to sort of bring together a collection of research that really takes a positive psychology style approach, which is where the concept of flourishing comes from, to the well-being of people who are transgender or non-binary. So in recent years, and I'm talking sort of recent in the scale of human history, there has been the increasingly pervasive idea put forward, you know, unfortunately, by many cisgender psychologists until recently, that being transgender is in itself a mental illness. And part of the supposed evidence for that is sort of highly elevated rates of depression, anxiety, and other mental health conditions compared to the general population, in addition to the kind of shockingly elevated rates of suicidal ideation and attempted and death by suicide in this community. So about 40% of trans or non-binary people in the U.S. attempt suicide in their lifetime, compared to about 4% of the general population, and similar disparities exist across cultures globally.
That 4 to 40% is an order of magnitude difference. Was that surprising or shocking in any way? Did it play into your understanding of the underlying problems?
Yeah, when people pathologize being trans, they're basically claiming that being transgender is what causes these outcomes. But of course, all of this is sort of happening in a cultural context in which people are, you know, not only being told they shouldn't exist, but that they actually don't exist. That's the idea of the gender binary, at least in its enforced form. It's sort of the idea, you know, that all males are men and all females are women. And if you don't feel that way, you shouldn't trust your own mind. And that sort of lifelong societal and interpersonal gaslighting, in addition to outright harassment and physical violence that many people, and in particular trans and non-binary people of color, face. When you take that away and start to look at people who are transgender but live in a supportive social context where their friends and family and maybe even their community treat them in line with their self-image, those effects almost completely disappear. Which, of course, leads to the conclusion that the problem, you know, obviously isn't people being trans, it's transphobic bias. And that's where the concept of flourishing comes in, because when anyone is able to meet their basic needs for acceptance and autonomy, we all have better outcomes.
That makes perfect sense. Really being accepted, valued for who you are certainly has countless benefits, and the opposite has countless detriments. In the course of your writing, did you find anything compelling or unexpected?
Yeah. So aside from these sort of specific hard numbers, I don't think there was much in this article that a trans or non-binary person couldn't have told our readers based on just their own experience. But even being non-binary myself, I was actually pretty surprised at just how strong the effects of social support and access to trans healthcare were found to be. Across various studies, people who were referred to by their correct name or pronouns, as well as people who wanted and then received at least one form of gender-affirming surgery, were less than half as likely to have reported attempting suicide in the past year, and were, and even more impressively, you know, young people who described their parents as being highly supportive were found to be 93% less likely to have attempted suicide in the past year. So that basic sort of foundational support at home almost prevented that disparity from occurring in the first place. And it's really encouraging to know that from, you know, an objective sort of empirical standpoint, there really is the possibility of trans and non-binary people getting to live safe, satisfying lives like anyone else.
So if there was something in this article you wished the public more widely understood and appreciated, what would it be?
The main thing that I wish for more sort of widely understood about being trans or non-binary is that, you know, for all of the back and forth about the existence of this group of people as a sort of issue, you know, none of the findings highlighted in this article are really unique to trans people. You know, most people want to feel accepted enough to form meaningful relationships with others and to know that they have control, you know, as much as anyone does over their own mind and body. And, you know, it's really that simple.
Well, I would like to thank you for joining us today. This has been Charles Blue, and I've been speaking with my colleague Kim Armstrong, as well as Erlia Leah Thayer and Ludmilla Nunj. Thank you very much for joining me.
Under the Cortex is a production of the Association for Psychological Science, which is dedicated to advancing scientific psychology across disciplinary and geographic borders.